with the ability to argue and defend why you ought to believe and why he believes what he believes. Faith founded on fact. He's a university campus favorite. I love the way his logic and reason operates. And then we're going to do part two of this event tomorrow night. Doors will open up at 6, and the event will begin at 7 o'clock sharp. So allow yourself commute time. But listen, we're going to give you a little sample of what's going to happen tonight and tomorrow. Give a warm welcome to a United States Navy aviator, officer, apologetic, Dr. Frank Turek, with us this morning.
Thanks, brother.
You said I love you?
Ah, yeah, I love you too. Thank you, ladies and gentlemen. Thank you. Don't you love that guy?
Yeah.
Of course you do. You're so blessed to have Pastor Jack and Lisa here with you. Let me ask you a question as we start out today. What is the mission of the church? I don't just mean Calvary Chapel, Chino Hills. I mean the mission of the church worldwide. What's the mission? One at a time. Make disciples, preach the gospel, equip the saints, salvation. Do you know, I know this may sound a little weird, but I think it's true. You know what our number one goal is here on earth? Our number one priority, maybe is a better way of putting it, worship. I don't, when I mean worship, I'm not just talking about the music. I'm talking about your life. Your life is a life of worship because you're going to put something on the top rung of your priority, and it needs to be Jesus. It needs to be God. So it's worship. And the purpose of life is to know God and to make him known. And we have a role in doing that. In fact, someone mentioned here when I said, what's the purpose of the church? Someone said, make disciples. At the end of the Gospel of Matthew, Jesus says this. This is the end. Matthew chapter 28, verses 18 and 19. Then Jesus came to them and said, all authority in heaven and on earth has been given to me. All right, stop right there for a second. If you were to say all authority in heaven and earth has been given to me, we would send you down to the loony farm, right? This guy's not claiming just to be a human being, right? He's claiming to be God. So he says that, and then he says, therefore, go and make disciples of all nations. Notice he doesn't say make believers. Disciples, somebody who follows. Make disciples of all nations, baptize in the name of the Father, Son, and Holy Spirit, and teaching them everything I've commanded you to do. And he said, I'm going to be with you to the end of the age. Now, do you ever hear doubt that Christianity's true? I do. I wrote a book called I Don't Have Enough Faith to Be an Atheist, and some days I don't have enough faith to be a Christian. Now, this is verses 18 and 19. Do you know what happens in verse 17? Look at this. You've probably never even noticed this before. You know, you read the Bible, you read it 100 times, and you never notice something? Look at the verse before. When they saw him, they worshiped him, but some doubted. What? This is in the Bible? He's standing right in front of them, resurrected, and they're going, I don't think it's him. Nope, not him. They're doubting. Now, apparently, a little bit later, they decided they weren't doubting anymore. They became the most effective evangelical, peaceful missionary force the history of the world has ever known. But they doubted. Now, let's just say for the sake of argument that Christianity is true. It is, but let's just, for the sake of argument, it's true. It really happened. There is a God. You are not him. Jesus added humanity over his deity. He came to earth. He lived a perfect life in our place. He allowed the creatures whom he created to torture and kill him so he could take the punishment on himself that we should have taken so we could then be reconciled to him. Let's just say all that's true. And you doubt it. Does your psychological state change the fact that Christianity is true? Your psychological state doesn't change a thing about the reality of God or Jesus. Either Jesus is God or he's not, regardless of what you think about it. Either God exists or he doesn't, regardless of what you think about it. The resurrection really happened. If it really did, it's true, even if you doubt it to the day you die. So you know what? We ought to not concentrate on our doubts. We ought to concentrate on the evidence, because the evidence will tell you whether or not it's really true. And once you look at the evidence, I think you ought to start doubting your doubts. Because if you start doubting your doubts, then you're back to knowing something for sure. Have you guys ever thought about doubting your doubts? I doubt it. I actually think there's extremely good evidence that Christianity's true, that the resurrection really happened. In fact, I think it's so good that you can't make this stuff up. In fact, today we're going to talk about three reasons that you can't make this up. There's no way this is a made-up story. What you read about in the New Testament is not made up. And the first reason is because there's embarrassing stories in the text that they never would have invented. Embarrassing stories. And what embarrassing stories tell historians is this. If there's something embarrassing to the author or authors in a particular historical document, it's probably true. Why? Because you're never going to invent embarrassing details about yourself. You might invent things that make you look good, but you won't invent embarrassing details that make you look bad, right? In fact, let me ask you guys a question. How many people in here have ever lied to make yourself look good? If you don't have your hand up right now, you're lying to make yourself look good, and it's not working. We know you're lying. All right, how many people in here have ever lied to make yourself look bad? Now, you don't lie to make yourself look bad. You might lie to make yourself look good, but you won't lie to make yourself look bad. Well, the New Testament writers have filled, this is true of the Old Testament as well, but we're just looking at the New Testament this morning. The New Testament writers have filled the New Testament with embarrassing stories, embarrassing events, embarrassing details that they never would have invented. That's why we call this the Duff Factor. They're not making this up. Let me just give you a few examples. Notice that the New Testament writers depict themselves as dim-witted. They fail to understand what Jesus is talking about several times. They don't get his mission. In fact, they don't really understand completely what his mission is until he's already ascended to heaven after the resurrection. Up to that point, they don't get it. Then he ascends to heaven, and then they go, wow, I could have had a V8, right? But up to that point, they don't get it. And then they make no effort to give Jesus a proper burial. Who buries Jesus? Joseph of Arimathea and Nicodemus. Joseph of Arimathea is a member of the Sanhedrin. That's the Jewish ruling council that sentenced Jesus to die. Why would they make Joseph look like a good guy while they ran away and hid for fear of the Jews? And why would they put Jesus in a Jewish tomb? That's what the text says. He was in a Jewish tomb. What could the Jews have done if they wanted to stop Christianity? And they did. They didn't want it to be true. If the Christians began claiming Jesus had risen from the dead, but Jesus' own rotting body was in their own tomb, what could they have done? They could have gone to the tomb, taken out the body, game over, Christianity's fault. They didn't do that. They said the disciples came and stole the body while the guards were asleep. Now, that's a bad explanation, by the way, for at least two reasons. Why? Reason number one, if you're a Roman guard on duty and you fall asleep on watch, what happens to you? You're toast. Reason number two, if you're a Roman guard on duty and you fall asleep on watch, how do you know what happened? Are you guys asleep? We were sleeping, see, and we noticed while we were sleeping that the disciples came right down here. Now, that doesn't make any sense. And by the way, it's not just in the Bible that this story is put forth. Because early on in Christianity, there's an ongoing debate between the Christians who keep saying Jesus has risen from the dead and the Jews who keep saying the disciples came and stole the body while the guards were asleep. Well, that explanation, what does that explanation imply? That the tomb's empty, right? You don't have to come up with a story for an empty tomb if he's still in it. They're admitting that the tomb is empty by saying the disciples came and stole the body while the guards were asleep. They're admitting it. Also notice, talk about embarrassing details, that their leader, Peter, is called Satan by Jesus. Do you think they invented this? Do you think at one point, Mark, who wrote this down, said to Peter, hey, Pete, I'm going to make this a real interesting story. I'm going to have the Lord call you Satan. What do you think Mark would have said, or Peter would have said? Have him call you Satan. Why is he calling me Satan? I'm the leader here. This is embarrassing. And then Peter says, Lord, I'll never deny you. And then what does he wind up doing? He denies him three times after saying, Lord, I'll never deny. That's not good PR. You can't make this up. And then at the crucifixion, the disciples run away. And who are the brave ones? The women, that's right. The women are the brave ones. Now, yeah, that's right, ladies. You can give yourselves a hand. That's right. I am woman, hear me roar. Now, who wrote the New Testament down? Men. Now, what man is going to invent that he was hiding for fear of the Jews? Why the women went down and discovered the empty tomb. Would any man in here invent that? No man in here would invent it. I mean, if I was there, if I was inventing it, I'd write something down like this. Let's see. We march right down to that tomb and we overpowered that elite Roman guard. Yeah, that sounds good. John said, get out. Peter, roundhouse kicked him. Philip said, we'll be back. And then on Sunday morning, we marched right down to the tomb, and we saw Jesus, who congratulated us on our great faith. And then we went and comforted the trembling women. I would never say I was Mr. Sissy Pants. Why, the women went down and discovered the empty tomb. And oh, by the way, if you were making up this story, not only would it be embarrassing to say the women were the first witnesses, but you would never make it up that way in the first century. Why? Because a woman's testimony was not considered on par with that of a man. So if you're making up the New Testament story, you'd only have the men be the first witnesses. Yet all four Gospels say the women were the first witnesses, which is telling us what? They were! As embarrassing as it was. You can't make this up! Actually, I had a lady come up to me once, and she said, no, I know why Jesus appeared to the women first. And I said, why? And she said, because he wanted to get the story out. I said, that is an excellent point. I had not thought of that. Because, ladies, when your man comes home from work, does he say much? There could have been a nuclear explosion down at the plant. He's not going to tell you. You'll see it on the news before you hear it from him. You'll be watching Eyeball News going, hey, hon, what happened? Oh, yeah, I forgot to tell you. The nuke blew up 3 days ago. I've been hot for 3 days. What's for dinner? He's not going to tell you. And then at the crucifixion, or at the resurrection, at the final ascension to heaven, or at the Great Commission, I should say, what we just had up there, Matthew chapter 28. Jesus is standing there giving them the Great Commission, and it says, some believed, but some doubted. Can you believe this? They're standing there, and some of them are going, that's Jesus. And the other guy's going, no, that can't be Jesus. He was just killed not long ago. No, I'm telling you, it's Jesus. It can't be Jesus. The Romans killed him. I'm telling you, the guy's dead. It's Jesus. It can't be. They put a spear in his side. Blood and water came out. He was crucified. He was whipped. He's dead. It's Jesus. It can't be. It is. How do you know? The women told me. They're not making this up. You can't make this up. Actually, there's a even potentially embarrassing details about Jesus in there. Do you know that Jesus, his own family thinks Jesus is out of his mind. In Mark chapter 3, they want to seize him and take him home. Now, you may have heard the scholars say, well, the New Testament writers invented Jesus to be God. Oh, really? Then why are they saying in Mark chapter 3, the New Testament writers, why is Mark saying that his own family thought he was nuts? They're not making that up. Do you know his own brother didn't think he was God? His own brother wasn't following him, James. Wasn't following. He had other brothers too. It says in John 7:5, it says his own brothers didn't believe in him. Very embarrassing. We learn later, however, that James, the half-brother of Jesus, who wrote that little book in the New Testament called James. You guys are very wise. Pastor Jack, you're doing a great job back there. James dies as a martyr in 62 AD in the very city of Jerusalem that Jesus is alleged to have risen from the dead in. He dies as a martyr. The Sanhedrin throw him off the Temple Mount and then they stone him to death. And you know who tells us this? Nobody in the New Testament tells us this. Josephus, the Jewish historian, who lived from 37 AD to about 100 AD. He was probably in Jerusalem at the time. He tells us that James is killed. Now, why is James dying as a martyr for his own brother in the same city in which Jesus is alleged to have risen from the dead in, when 30 years earlier in that very city, he didn't think Jesus was God? He didn't think his own brother was God. Paul basically tells us. In 1 Corinthians 15, Paul says that Jesus appeared to James resurrected. That must have convinced James that his own brother was God. And before that, he said, bro, you ain't God. After the resurrection, bro, you're God, right? Now, how many people in here have a brother? All right, how many people have a brother who thinks he's God? Yeah. You don't believe in him either. Neither did James until the resurrection. Also, there's embarrassing comments about Jesus in the text that you can't make up. Like, for example, he's called demon-possessed. He's called a drunkard. Jesus is called a drunkard. He has his feet wiped with the hair of a prostitute, which easily could have been seen as a sexual advance. And oh, by the way, you notice there are two prostitutes in Jesus' bloodline? Who are they? Rahab and Tamar. Do you think Matthew and Luke got together, the ones that recorded the genealogies at one point, and they said, you know what? I really think we need to spice up the Messiah's bloodline a little bit. Let's put a couple of prostitutes in there. Rahab, Tamar. No, I don't think they did that. In fact, there's a lot of shady characters in the bloodline. Judah, from where we get the term Jew from, not a good guy. Look him up. David's in there. Oh, everyone loves David. Oh, yeah, he's a liar, adulterer, and a murderer. And he's a man after God's own heart. Gee, I guess there's hope for the rest of us. Just making this up. Bathsheba's in there. And do you know that Bathsheba is in the genealogy, but her name isn't used, but you know who it is. Why? What does it say? In the genealogy, it says, Uriah's wife. Ooh. That's a slam, isn't it? Because Uriah was the husband of Bathsheba, whom David had killed, so he could have Bathsheba. In fact, out of the five women that are listed in the genealogy, only one is a Jew. You've got Rahab, Tamar, Ruth the Moabitess, Bathsheba. Who's the only Jew? Mary. Mary is the only Jew. This is embarrassing for the Hebrew nation. They don't even mention any Hebrews in there, except Mary. I mean, you want the ultimate no-spin zone? You know what it is? It's the New Testament. You can't make this stuff up. They're not. It's not a made-up story. It's too embarrassing. If a Pharaoh's historian recorded in the Pharaoh's genealogy prostitutes and murderers, what do you think the Pharaoh would do to his historian? Off with your head. No, the New Testament's just telling you the truth. So is the Old, by the way. They're not making it up. You can't make this up. It's true. So embarrassing details or embarrassing stories is one reason why I believe they're telling the truth here. The second reason is there's embedded confirmation throughout the New Testament. And it's true of the Old as well. But again, we're just going to look at the New. What do I mean by embedded confirmation? This is a difficult one to communicate by definition. I'm going to show you what it is by definition. But then I'm going to show you some examples. And hopefully then it'll communicate well. I'm excited to do this because I've never done this before a church audience before. I've done it on our TV show for a couple of hours. But this evidence we're about to look out here is the best evidence that the New Testament's telling the truth that you've never heard of. In fact, I didn't hear of it until just about 5 years ago. Some people call these things undesigned coincidences. I don't really like that, so I've changed it to call it embedded confirmation. It's also called elaborate testimony in our book, Stealing from God. But here, let me explain what it is. What embedded confirmation is, and again, it'll be clear after the definition. I'm going to show you some examples, but here's the definition or a description of what embedded confirmation is. Embedded confirmation is embedded just below the surface of the New Testament storyline is a series of interlocking puzzle pieces which confirm that the New Testament documents could not have been invented. Instead, they contained independent witness or eyewitness testimony of actual historical events. And what this means is there's details in one narrative of the same event that are filled in by details in another narrative or another gospel of the same event. They couldn't be contrived. You'll see what we mean as I go through this. I'm going to give you five examples. The first is from Matthew chapter 8, the healing at Peter's house. Now, this is an actual picture of Peter's house. Archaeologists are very firm in their contention that Peter's house is in Capernaum, and they've located it. How many have been with Pastor Jack and Lisa to Israel, a trip to Israel? Can I see your hands, please? Wow. Well, they're going to go again next year. You're going to want to go on this trip. If you ever get a chance to go, Capernaum, for me, it's my favorite spot in Israel. It's on the Sea of Galilee. It's Jesus' adopted hometown, and in Capernaum, you will stand where Jesus stood, basically. You will see where Peter lived. You will see the synagogue there. And what happens in Matthew chapter 8 is Matthew describes a healing there. And here's how he describes it. But he leaves a bit of a puzzle. He says, "And when Jesus entered Peter's house, he saw his mother-in-law lying sick with a fever. He touched her hand and the fever left her. And she rose and began to serve him. That evening, they brought to him many who were oppressed by demons and cast out the spirits with a word and healed all who were sick." Now, why am I highlighting that evening? Let me ask you a question. If a healer is in your town and you're sick and he's healing somebody right there at somebody's house, are you going to wait to that evening to go over to his house and ask to be healed? Or are you going to go over there right away? Right? Because he might leave, right? Jesus was always on the move. I'm not going to wait till that evening to go see him. I'm going to go see him as soon as I see he's healing somebody. I'm going to go over there too, right? Wouldn't you? So this is a bit of a puzzle. Why wait till evening for healing? Matthew leaves a puzzle, but thankfully Mark solves the puzzle for us. Because if you go to Mark's account, here is how Mark describes it. On the Sabbath, he entered the synagogue and was teaching, and immediately he left the synagogue and entered the house of Simon and Andrew with James and John. Now, Simon's mother-in-law lay ill with a fever. That evening at sundown, they brought to him all who were sick or oppressed by demons. They waited till the evening. Why? It was the Sabbath. They couldn't go over there before then. You see, now you've got a question in Matthew, but when you read Mark's account, you go, ah, there's a detail that Matthew didn't include. And now they're connecting. Do you see that? Now, if you get to go there, this is how close these two places are. The synagogue in Capernaum, that's actually about a third century synagogue. The one that Jesus taught in is in the same spot. It's just down a layer. In fact, you can see the basalt layer of the foundation of Jesus' synagogue, the one he taught in, right under that white one there. And right next to it is Peter's house. Peter lived in the Millennium Falcon. I don't know if you know that. And he had a friend named Luke. It all fits. Actually, that crazy-looking church, it's a Roman Catholic church, was built there, I think, in the 90s. When you go into that church, there's a plexiglass floor, so you can actually see down into the remains of Peter's house right there. But you see how close those two things are? When you go to Capernaum, you can see how all these things, the logistics of it, the layout of it, how it all fits together. Now, what we're saying here is that, and there's a picture of that church from the front. When you walk through the gate in Capernaum, that's what you see. What we're saying here is that Mark actually solves a question we have about Matthew. These are two accounts of the same event, like two newspaper reports of the same event giving different details, okay? That's example one. Let's go to example two. In John chapter 6, the feeding of the 5,000. Now, you may have read this and not caught this, but because you know how you read something, you read it 100 times, you don't catch it. 100 first time, you go, "Why? Well, I didn't even notice that. You even notice that?" Check this out in the feeding of the 5,000. At the feeding of the 5,000, here's what John records. He records Jesus asking Philip, "Where are they going to buy bread so that these people may eat? Where are we going to get some bread, Philip?" Now, here's the question. Here's the puzzle for me. When you look at that, you go, Why is Jesus asking Philip, a minor character, about where to buy these things? Why not ask a leader like Peter or John, right? Who's Philip? He's not a prominent character here. I would ask a leader like Peter or John, hey, where are we going to get food to feed all these people? Well, John doesn't tell us, but Luke does. But inadvertently, here's what Luke does. Luke, and only Luke, mentions that Bethsaida was the location of the feeding of the 5,000. Elsewhere, John records that Philip was from Bethsaida in Galilee. Can anyone see the connection right now? What's the connection? The connection is Jesus is asking Philip because Philip is from Bethsaida. So you're going to ask the local guy where the food is, right? Like, I'm from Charlotte, North Carolina. That's where I live now. I used to live in New Jersey. Can you tell? That's where I'm from. I'm originally from New Jersey. Anyway, if you saw Pastor Jack and myself on the street in Charlotte, even though you might know Pastor Jack better and you know he's the leader, you know, he's very prominent, if you're going to ask, where should we go to eat? You're not going to ask him. He doesn't know. You're going to ask me, right? That's what's going on here. Actually, Jack probably wouldn't know where to go, right? He'd probably know where to eat. But this is a minor detail. You don't even notice it. But then you realize these are complementary accounts, that you couldn't invent these things. They're too subtle. They're complementary accounts of the same event. Actually, in this case, it's not even an account of the event. Luke isn't talking about the feeding of the 5,000. He just, in an offhanded way, says, oh, by the way, Philip is from Bethsaida. Oh, and then you put two and two together and you solve the problem, see? So we not only have Mark solving Matthew, now we have Luke solving John. Now we're going to go to Luke chapter 23, Jesus and Pilate. And when you read this account in Luke, you got to be scratching your head. Because here's what Luke says about this. The Jews accused Jesus before Pilate. We found this man, you know, trying to mislead our nation, and he's forbidding us to give tribute to Caesar and saying that he himself is Christ, a king. That's not going to be good to Pilate's ears, right? And Pilate asked him to, he asked Jesus, are you the king of the Jews? And Jesus answered him, yeah, you have said so. You've said so. Then Pilate said to the chief priests and the crowds, I find no guilt in this man. What? Wait a minute. He just admitted the charge. He basically said to Jesus, how do you plead? Guilty. Okay, I find you not guilty. You got to be going, what's going on here? You just read Luke and you're left with a puzzle, right? Well, in order to figure this out, you got to go over to John. Because here's what John says. He gives us a detail Luke doesn't give. Pilate entered his headquarters again and called Jesus and said to him, are you the king of the Jews? And Jesus answered, my kingdom is not of this world. Pilate went back outside to the Jews and told them, I find no guilt in him. Do you see? Pilate says, Jesus thinks he's a kingdom. He's a king in another world. Well, that's no threat to Caesar. It's no threat to you, Jews. He's a little bit loony. He thinks he has a kingdom somewhere else. Don't worry about him. He's not guilty. You see this? You don't get it from just Luke. You got to go to John. So what we're saying here is we not only got Mark affirming Matthew, we've got Luke solving John. Now we've got John solving Luke. Here's one more. Matthew chapter 26, the beating of Jesus. Matthew leaves us with a puzzle. After Jesus admits he's the Messiah, the high priest tore his clothes and said, he has spoken blasphemy. Why do we need any more witnesses? Look, now you have heard the blasphemy. What do you think? He is worthy of death, they answered. Then they spit in his face and struck him with their fists. Others slapped him and said, prophesy to us, Christ. Who hit you? Prophesy to us, Christ. Who hit you? Why would they ever say that to him? He's standing right in front of them. They hit him. Jesus should be able to see them, right? What's this prophecy business? It doesn't take a genius or a prophet to know who hit you when the guy's standing right in front of you. So you're reading that going, yeah, Matthew, that seems kind of odd. You sure that's the way it went down? You got to go on over to Luke, because now Luke will solve Matthew for us. Luke includes a detail about the same event that Matthew doesn't include, and it solves the whole problem. Look what Luke says. The men who were guarding Jesus began mocking and beating him. They blindfolded him. So he couldn't see. That's why when they hit him, they said, prophesy to us, you prophet. Who just hit you? You wouldn't get that alone. by reading Matthew, you got to go over to Luke. Do you see how these fit together? It's like two newspaper reports talking about the same event, giving details that the other doesn't, and vice versa. So we not only have Mark solving Matthew or confirming Matthew, and Luke confirming John, and John confirming Luke. Now we've got Luke confirming Matthew. Now there are more than 60 of these in the New Testament. We only have time to do five of them. I'm going to show you one more. This one is not between two gospels. This is between a gospel and an outside source. Matthew chapter 2, returning from Egypt. You remember Joseph and Mary and the baby Jesus escaped to Egypt in order to avoid Herod, who wants to murder all the babies. Remember this? So he goes down there, and he's down there for a little while, and then he has a dream, and he's told to come back to Israel. And this guy is Archelaus. He is the Roman ruler of Judea for about 10 years because his father, Herod the Great, died in 4 BC, and his kingdom was divided up amongst his sons, and this guy got the area of Judea. And here's what we read in Matthew. It's a little bit of a puzzle because Matthew records that Joseph had a dream in Egypt to return to Israel with Mary and the child Jesus. But when Joseph heard that Archelaus was reigning in Judea in place of his father Herod, he was afraid to go there. Having been warned in a dream, he withdrew to the district of Galilee and he went and lived in a town called Nazareth. Now, what's the puzzle? The puzzle is, why is Joseph afraid of Archelaus? Matthew doesn't say a word. He just mentions the guy. Like everybody should know. Here we have to go to Josephus, the Jewish historian who lived from 37 AD to about 100 AD. He was probably in Jerusalem at the time when he recorded that James had been murdered as a martyr. Remember we talked about him earlier? But now he's doing a history of the Jews, and here's what he says about this guy Archelaus, who lived just prior to Josephus. Matthew doesn't tell us who this Archelaus is, but Josephus does. Here's what he says. In putting down a disturbance at the temple in 4 BC, Josephus tells us that Archelaus sent in troops and slaughtered 3,000 Jews. Passover was canceled. In other words, when Archelaus took over, he wanted to assert that he was really the man in charge. And when there was a disturbance down at the temple, Archelaus sent his Roman soldiers in. He said, just kill everybody. That'll teach these Jews. Well, can you imagine? Joseph and Mary and the baby or toddler Jesus at that point are coming up the road from Egypt. And Jews who were living in Egypt but would come to Israel for Passover were returning from Passover, going back to Egypt on the same road. And they run into Joseph and they say, have you heard what Archelaus has done? He killed 3,000 of our own? I'm not going to that area. I fled Judea to escape a homicidal maniac. I'm not going back there. So he goes to the north. He goes up by the Sea of Galilee. Now, again, no New Testament document tells us this. Josephus does. So we not only got Mark confirming Matthew and Luke confirming Matthew and Luke confirming John and John confirming Luke. Now we bring in an outside source, Josephus, and he tells us something about Matthew that confirms Matthew. Now, that's just five examples. We could spend semesters going through these examples. As I say, they're sometimes called undesigned coincidences or elaborate testimony. I call them embedded confirmation. And really, what this embedded confirmation does, when you have all these pieces and you put them together, you get a much clearer portrait of who Jesus really is. You get four portraits or four biographies of Jesus among the four, Matthew, Mark, Luke, and John. And you get a much clearer picture. In fact, when I did this on our TV show, we spent two shows on it, two one-hour shows. We went through 15 or 20 of these embedded confirmations. This is what the chart looked like when we were done. And this is just 15 or so of them. There's more than 60 of them that have been identified. I mean, they're cross-confirmation in one another. And you bring in archaeology, you not only bring in Josephus, you bring in Tacitus and Suetonius, these other non-Christian writers, and you get cross-confirmation. You get embedded confirmation. So much so that this man, J. Warner Wallace, the cold case homicide detective who will be here tonight, who wrote the book Cold Case Christianity, for those of you who weren't here last year when we did Fearless Faith 1, Jim was here, and Jim is a cold case homicide detective, as Jack said. He's been on Dateline 4 times solving cold case murders that are decades old. For years, he was a detective at the Torrance Police Department, and now he's been on Dateline several times because these murders that he solves are very interesting. And he took those skills he used to investigate cold case homicides and apply that. He applied those to the greatest homicide of all time, the homicide of Jesus, to see if it really did occur. And that's what the book Cold Case Christianity is about. And in that book, here's what Jim says about these 4 different gospels and these different details. He says the early believers could have destroyed all but one of the accounts, changed the conflicting details, or simply harmonized the gospels. But these diverse accounts were preserved as they are because they are true. They display all the earmarks of what we would expect in true eyewitness testimony. If the early church had eliminated the 4 eyewitness perspectives and limited us to 1 tidy version, we would inevitably have missed some significant detail. In fact, there was a guy early on in the second century, Marcion, who tried to say, I'm going to get rid of all the Gospels except just Luke. Just obey Luke. Because he thought that they were contradictory. When they weren't, they were just complementary. You see, you get these 4 portraits. They come together and they help you see that these are independent testimonies of the same events. And it's much richer to read these 4 than if you had just 1. You can't make this up. It's too subtle to make up these kinds of embedded confirmations. So we've got embarrassing stories. We have embedded confirmation. Finally, we have excruciating details. The 3rd reason you can't make this up. And this has to do with the fact that these apostles, who could have saved themselves by saying Jesus had never risen from the dead, actually died saying he had risen from the dead, and they were Jews. What motive did they have to make up a resurrected Jesus? This is a painting of Peter being crucified upside down at Caravaggio. We don't actually know if he was crucified upside down, but we have very good evidence he was martyred for his faith, as well as Paul and others, James, as I mentioned earlier. In fact, before we look at their martyrdoms, let's look at the apostles' beliefs and practices before and after the resurrection. I'm going to make a quick 2-column chart here. And this 2-column chart, as we go through this, I want you to recognize that all of the New Testament writers, with the exception of Luke, were all Jews. They already thought they were God's chosen people. They had a religion over 2,000 years old. They thought it was true. What motive would they have to invent a resurrected Jesus? Here's what they believed before Jesus showed up. They believed in animal sacrifice, right? After Jesus comes along, they say Christ's sacrifice is enough. You know, they had been slaying lambs and other animals to Yahweh for hundreds of years. And then suddenly Jesus comes along and they go, we don't need to slay all these lambs anymore. Because these lambs are just symbols of the Lamb of God who takes away the sins of the world. Here he is right here. The whole sacrificial system is a symbol of the true sacrifice. We don't need to do this anymore. He's here. Before, they believed in a binding law of Moses. Afterwards, they say Christ's life is enough. In fact, Christ himself does away with the dietary laws. In Mark chapter 7, he says, it's not what goes into a man that defiles him, it's what comes out of a man. He does away with it. Before, they believed in strict monotheism. Afterwards, they're believing in a Trinity. 3 persons in 1 divine essence. Yes, I know the Trinity is hinted at in the Old Testament, but it's much clearer in the New. Before, they believed in the Sabbath. In fact, they thought they could be stoned for not obeying the Sabbath. Afterwards, they're worshiping on Sunday. And Paul writes in Colossians chapter 2, don't let anyone tell you you have to obey any Sabbath or festival day. Why? What did the Sabbath represent? Rest. Who is our rest? Jesus is our rest. He's here. The Sabbath just symbolized our true rest. We rest in the work of Jesus. In fact, out of the 10 commandments, 9 of them are repeated in the New Testament. What's the only one that isn't? Keep holy the Sabbath. Because the Sabbath's been fulfilled by Jesus. Before, they believed in the conquering Messiah, afterwards a sacrificial Messiah. Oh, Jesus is going to conquer when he comes again, but he came as a sacrifice first. Before, they believed in circumcision, afterwards they're believing in baptism and communion. Now, ladies and gentlemen, what would cause these pious Jews who thought they were God's chosen people to abandon everything on the left and adopt everything on the right virtually overnight. What would cause them to do this? The only thing I can think of is what psychologists call an impact event. What's an impact event? An impact event is an event that occurs in your life that is so dramatic, so impactful, that it can change your perspective 180 degrees overnight. I mean, you might not remember what you had for breakfast this morning, but you'll remember an impact event that happened 10, 20, 30, 40, 50 years ago if you're old enough. Some of you, most of you won't be able to answer this question, but I'm going to ask it anyway. Some of you can. If you can remember where you were and what you were doing November 22nd, 1963, raise your hand and hold it up. Hold it up. Look around the room, ladies and gentlemen. You see these people with their hands up? These people are very old. November 22nd, 1963 is my earliest memory. I was 2 years old and 2 days. And I was standing in the living room at our house in Wanamassa, New Jersey. I'm a toddler. And my mother is sitting on an ottoman in front of a black and white TV, weeping uncontrollably. Mommy, what's the matter? What's the matter? They killed the president. They killed the president. President Kennedy assassinated that day. I can still see my mother as if she were sitting there right now when she was 26 years old. I can see her in my mind right there, right now. She's 79 today. But I can see her when she was 26. That's my earliest memory. I don't remember anything before that and very little after that. Where were you when the second plane hit the tower? Most of you know something about 9/11, don't you? I was on the phone in my office. I lived near Charlotte, North Carolina. I had the TV on behind me. And I was talking on the phone to a pastor who lived on the north side of Charlotte, and he wanted me to come to his church, and we were trying to figure out what the topic would be. And I said, do you have the TV on? He goes, yeah. I said, maybe a Cessna or something hit the World Trade Tower. And he went, yeah, that's possible. And we were just talking back and forth, and suddenly he goes, the second tower just got hit. I turned around, I look at the TV, the second tower's on fire. I said, was it a Cessna? He goes, no, it was like a United plane. It was a passenger plane. It was a big plane. It flew right in there and exploded. I said, you saw that? He goes, it was just on live TV. I said, look, let me call you back. Hung up the phone. For some reason that morning, I had CNN on. The Communist News Network. Now, I'm not making this up, but the commentator on CNN said this. One has to think there's some sort of navigational error here. I said, navigational error? You dimwit. Hey, man, where are we going? No! This is terrorism. I called the pastor back the next day. I said, we're going to come to your church and talk about Islam, because that's what this is related to. Now, 9/11 was almost 16 years ago, but everybody in here can remember something about that day. But if I were to ask you where you were 16 days ago, most of you are going to go, let me look at my iPad. What was I doing that day? I don't know. Why can you remember something from 16 years ago but not 16 days ago? Because there was no impact event 16 days ago. Impact event 16 years ago. Do you think a resurrection would have been an impact event? I mean, if Jesus really rose from the dead, do you think they would have remembered, the disciples would have remembered everything Jesus said and did till the day they died? Would there be any problem remembering any of this? No, there's no other way I can figure out why they, as Jews, would have abandoned their sacred beliefs on the left and adopted these on the right overnight unless the resurrection actually occurred. In fact, you could look at it this way. What did the New Testament writers have to gain by making up a new religion? What did they have to gain? They already thought they were God's chosen people, right? Hey, we're going to start a new religion. We are? Yeah. Well, what's it going to get us? Well, first we'll get kicked out of the synagogue, and then we'll get beaten, tortured, and killed. Well, sign me up! What a great idea! Why haven't we thought of this earlier? You can't make this up, ladies and gentlemen. This is not invented. In fact, they had every motive to say the resurrection did not happen, not every motive to say it did. Now, I get this question a lot. Maybe you do as well if you're a Christian. If you're a non-Christian, maybe you thought about this question. The question is this. Are there any non-Christian writers that talk about Jesus and the apostles? Or Jesus and the resurrection, or what happened in the first century? And the answer is yes. In fact, in chapter 9 of I Don't Have Enough Faith to Be an Atheist, we go through what some of these other non-Christian writers say. But you know what the question really assumes? There's an assumption underneath the question, and the assumption is this. Well, you can't really trust what the New Testament writers said because, you know, they were religious. And religious people embellish things. They make things up. They lie. Right, if you think about that for more than 10 seconds, you'll realize how stupid that is. Why? What motive would the New Testament writers, again being Jews, have to make up a resurrected Jesus? Why would a religion who believes in strict monotheism believe that a man actually is God and that he's risen from the dead unless it really happened? Why would they do that? They wouldn't. That's the point. They wouldn't do it. It really happened. I actually was watching the Discovery Channel, which is always a mistake, around Easter one year, and they had one of these specials on, like, what do we really know about Jesus and search for the real Jesus? You know, they never look in the Bible, obviously. In fact, they said at the beginning of the show, they said, well, what we think we know about Jesus of Nazareth comes from the pages of the New Testament, but since those pages were written by the converted, we can't trust them. What question are they leaving out? Why were they converted? Right? Why would they convert themselves to something that wasn't true and then go die for it? How does that make any sense? Why would they die for a known lie? You say, wait a minute, Frank, you just got done talking about 9/11 and Islam. Muslims don't even believe Jesus died or rose from the dead. Surah 4, verse 157, fourth chapter in the Quran, says he never died. Substitute was put on the cross. He was taken right to heaven. Jesus was. So the New Testament's false on that point. But they'll go die for it. Does martyrdom prove Islam's true? No. Why not? Well, before we get there, I happened to be in London a couple of weeks ago when these terrorist attacks hit. In fact, I was about to speak at a church the next day, and I changed my message to deal with the terrorist attacks the next day to talk about if God, why evil. But that afternoon, so Sunday, the attacks happened on a Saturday night. Sunday, I went down to Speaker's Corner. And most of you in here know what Speaker's Corner is because you've had the great Jay Smith here, right? You know Jay? So I texted Jay. I said, Jay, you're going to be at Speaker's Corner today? He said, absolutely. Come on down. Speaker's Corner, for those of you that don't know, in London, in Hyde Park, there's a place you go and you can usually bring a little ladder or step stool and you stand up there and you preach or say whatever you want. And Jay, who's a Christian, who's been over there for 25 years, he's an American, is an expert on Islam. And he'll go up there and he'll just stand and he'll talk and he'll debate people. Well, that day, I went down there. He's, of course, debating Muslims. And he says, what happened last night on the London Bridge actually is commanded in the Quran. Surah 8, Surah 9, strike the heads off the infidels, prepare the infidels for every ambush, don't take Christians and Jews for friends. You know, he goes through all the verses or several of the verses, and there are Muslims standing there arguing with him. If I could show it to you, I have it on my iPhone, right? He actually puts it on YouTube. You can go back and look at this. And what do you think the two arguments the young Muslims were bringing up to Jay? Number one, you're taking it out of context. And number two, you're a hater. Those are the two things you hear on the Communist News Network, aren't you? You hear that all the time. And no, he's not taking it out of context. Jihad has been going on for 1,400 years. It's not a new concept. Muhammad did it. It's commanded in the Quran, and it's in the Hadith, the written traditions of what Muhammad said and did. Now, thankfully, most Muslims don't agree with this. Thank you. But many do. And so Jay was just telling the truth. And they were trying to come back at him, but when they said, you're a hater. He said, I'm not a hater. He stuck out his hand and he shook their hands and he said, I love you with the love of Jesus and I would hate you if I didn't tell you the truth. But the Muslim martyrs of today, what's the difference between them and the Christian martyrs? There's a lot of differences, but the main difference for our purposes here is the Muslim martyrs don't have evidence that Islam is true. They just have faith. The New Testament martyrs, on the other hand, were in a position to know whether Jesus had risen from the dead. They saw Jesus. They touched Jesus. They ate with Jesus. They verified with their own senses that Jesus had risen from the dead. You see, many people will die for a lie they think is the truth. Nobody will die for a lie they know is a lie. And the New Testament martyrs were in a position to know whether it's a lie or not, and they went to their deaths anyway. You can't get better evidence than that unless you were there yourself. So you shouldn't even doubt it. So what's the conclusion? That you can't make this stuff up. Here's the overall conclusion. The New Testament writers did not create the resurrection. The resurrection created the New Testament writers. There would be no New Testament if it wasn't for the resurrection. Do you realize that? These, again, were Jews. Why would they invent a resurrected Jesus? I've said that 8 times already. Why? Because it's the point. They're not inventing this. They had no motive to invent it. They had every motive to say it wasn't true. Not every motive to say it was true. Now, the next sentence I'm about to say may sound heretical. Pastor Jack, if you're back there, it's not heresy. It's only going to sound like heresy for a minute. Are you guys ready? The resurrection, or let me back up. Christianity is not true because a book says it's true. Christianity is true because an event occurred, the resurrection. Do you realize there were thousands of Christians before a line of the New Testament was ever written? Do you realize that? How? How could this be? Because the resurrection occurred, and then they believed, and then they spread the word, and it wasn't until later that they wrote it down. Christianity is not based on a book. It's based on an event, the resurrection. There would be no New Testament if it wasn't for the resurrection. Now, thankfully, God saw it fit to inspire the writers to put this down into documents, which we then collected into a book, which helps us understand why it happened and how should we live then, obviously. But do you realize if the New Testament never existed, Christianity would still be true? Do you realize that? Because an event occurred. Our faith is grounded in history, in the truth that you can investigate. All right? So, by the way, there are more reasons you can't make this stuff up. We just went through 3 of them. If you get the book, I Don't Have Enough Faith to Be an Atheist, and the other book, Stealing from God, you're going to learn there are early sources out there. If we had time, we could go through that. There's also earlier prophecies that before Christ ever comes, they predict what would happen to him. In fact, Isaiah 53 is probably one of the better ones. I know Pastor Jack is preaching through Isaiah right now on Wednesday nights. Has he gotten to 53 yet? No, probably for another 6 years, okay? He might get there. Some of you will be dead. But this is an important book. I think he's in 40 or 41 right now. And the suffering servant passages begin about that time. But he'll get there eventually. Hang on. Hang on. Isaiah 53, if you want to jump ahead. Spoiler alert. Go Isaiah chapter 53. Read the whole thing, okay? Also, there's eyewitness details in there. In addition to the ones we've been through, there's many more. And there's extra biblical writers that are all listed in chapter 9 of I Don't Have Enough Faith to Be an Atheist. In other words, there is a lot more evidence than what we could even cover here this morning. So, some worshipped him, they worshipped him, but then some doubted. But they didn't doubt for very long. Why not? Because again, they went from scared, scattered, skeptical disciples to the most powerful, peaceful, evangelical missionary force the world has ever known to make disciples of all nations. And after they have done that, they told us to do that. And so we're supposed to follow in the footsteps of the apostles and do the same thing. Now, thankfully, you have a wonderful ministry here and fellowship here to help you do that and a wonderful set of leaders to help you do that. But this is what we're supposed to do every day. In addition to worship, we're supposed to make disciples, not only of ourselves, but others. And we ought not doubt it because the evidence is there. You can't make this up. It takes more faith not to believe it than to believe it. So, if you want to go further, you can. The books and the DVDs are actually in the gym this way. There's I Don't Have Enough Faith to Be an Atheist. There's Stealing from God. Ladies and gentlemen, Stealing from God is not about tithing. okay? The subtitle is Why Atheists Need God to Make Their Case. Atheists always steal from God when they're arguing against him. And then there's a full DVD set on all this called Why I Still Don't Have Enough Faith to Be an Atheist. And by the way, all the proceeds from the sale of the books and the DVDs will go to feed needy children. Mine. All right, just so you know. I got three sons, so I need some help. Actually, they're a little bit older now. In fact, I was in the Navy for 8 years, as Jack said, which, by the way, stands for Never Again Volunteer Yourself. But my sons were smarter than me. The oldest two went in the Air Force, and the oldest one is an intelligence officer. He's actually reading your email right now. And by the way, you shouldn't be emailing in church, okay? The second son is a KC-10 pilot up in Travis Air Force Base, north of here, up in between Sacramento and San Francisco. And a KC-10 is a big plane that flies up and refuels other planes, gives gas to other planes in flight. And so what we say about Spencer is that every day he flies up to 30,000 feet, he sits around, and he passes gas. And he gets paid for it. Every man's dream. If I got paid to pass gas, I'd be a multimillionaire already. Third son's not in the military, but he is out of the house, so we're empty nesters. Empty nesters in here? Yeah, it took us a while to get used to that. About 10 minutes. That's how long it took to change the locks. Anyway, all of the embedded confirmations I mentioned earlier and more you can get by going to that website, typing that into your browser, crossexamined.org/TV. If it goes to our TV page, put it in again. It's not supposed to go to the TV page. It's going to take you to a site where you put your email address in, and we're going to send you two PowerPoint presentations in a PDF form. You don't need PowerPoint to see it. And you can see all these different embedded confirmations. It's called elaborate testimony in these presentations. Those are from 2 hours of our TV show. We're not going to give your email address to anybody else. Just take that and use it for your own edification. Also, we're on YouTube, Twitter, and Facebook. In fact, two Facebook pages, if you like them, crossexamine.org, like that page, and also Dr. Frank Turk for Dr. Frank Turk. If you like those pages, you'll get these short videos we put up, like 2 or 3 minute Q&A videos from a college campus. We do a lot of college campus work. And they're good to share with others because I've noticed if you send a 45-minute video to somebody, they're not going to watch it. But if you send them a 4-minute Q&A video, they'll watch it. Okay, but you got to like the page to see these things, all right? We also live stream our college events quite frequently, so you'll be able to see those. We're also on YouTube and Twitter. In fact, we're so into YouTube, Twitter, and Facebook, we've combined these three into one social media platform. We call it YouTwitface. So you should sign up for that. It's kind of a Jersey thing. Have you signed up for YouTwitface yet? We're on radio and TV, and the TV show's on Wednesday nights on DirecTV, channel 378. And if you don't have DirecTV, it's on Roku. Do you guys have Roku? NRB TV. Just type in NRB, you'll find it. And if you don't have DirecTV or Roku, it's on this brand new thing. It just hit Chino Hills. It's called the Internet. Okay? So go to crossexamine.org, and you can watch the show streaming live. And if you don't do anything else, download the free app, the Cross-Examined app, two words in the App Store. This app will have all of our radio broadcasts and the TV show streaming live, and probably the most valuable part is it has a quick answer section to the common objections to Christianity. So you might be having lunch with somebody, and they say something that's wrong about Christianity. All you need to do is take out your iPhone, your Droid, or if you're one of the 7 people in the world with a Windows phone, it works on that too. Okay? And as they're talking, you can call up the Cross-Examined app and get an answer to their question or their objection. So you can go, hey, hang on, I'm getting a text. Hey, what about this? All right? It's free. Download it. Last thing, you really ought to come back tonight. Why? Because these handsome gentlemen will join me on stage here. You may know the guy on the left. He's been in here a couple of times. The guy in the middle is J. Warner Wallace, the cold case homicide detective. He'll be here tonight and tomorrow night. And Mike Adams, the UNCW, UNC Wilmington College professor. And we're going to go through Fearless Faith 2. Last year here we did Fearless Faith 1. In fact, on the book table is the DVD set for Fearless Faith 1. But tonight we're going to talk about issues like this. Tonight and tomorrow night. I'm not going to read them to you. You can see them up there. But the man who makes all this happen is the great Jack Hibbs. So he's going to come out here right now. Jack, where are you? Come on out here. Here he is, the great Jack Hibbs, ladies and gentlemen. Thanks, brother.
I told you about that guy. Listen, now, what Paul said to Timothy, he said, "Oh, Timothy, guard what has been committed to your trust. Avoid the profane and vain babblings and contradictions of what is falsely called science." Brilliant, huh? Coming out tonight, as you just heard Frank in his invitation to you. Let's all stand together as we begin to wrap this up. We were talking in the back, just realizing there's so much going on here today regarding expense of things. I just realized how much money it takes to come to this church. Because we've got the tote bag thing. We've got Frank's product, which is off the charts. Great investment as well. There's conferences to sign up. There's retreats to sign up for. You pray about what it is you'd like to get involved in. But by all means, if you can't make it back tonight, you ought to go to Frank's table and take with you part of what his ministry is all about. Because I got to tell you, it's going to equip you to talk to young people. Young people need to hear this stuff. A lot of young people today are just told in a blanket statement, you can't trust the Bible. And they just, okay. And both Frank and Jim and Mike, they're committed to getting people to think again. And I just love that. Listen, Jesus Christ died on the cross for our sins, so says the Bible. And you might say today, maybe you're not a Christian, and you're saying, well, how do we know that for sure? We can know it for sure. Number one, the Old Testament prophets said Christ would come. That's why your faith is founded upon fact. I love what Frank said about the truth being established before the New Testament was written. The New Testament is the eyewitness account of what was promised in the Old Testament. That's awesome. No other faith group, religion in the world can boast that but us. Christianity invites you to put your faith upon fact. So listen, if you're not a Christian today, you should become one, a follower of Jesus. We're not asking you to join this church because you can't. There's no membership here. We don't want your money. We don't need it. We want you to meet the one who loves you and died on the cross to forgive you of your sins, that you might inherit through him eternal life. It's all about Jesus. That's why we do what we do. So if you'd like to meet Jesus, he'll be right up here in a prayer. At the end of the song, you can come up and there'll be people here to pray with you and introduce you to Jesus. He's been waiting for you for a long time. Father, I pray that you'd bless, Lord, this second service as they're about to enter the world. They're about ready to go out into the mission field through these doors. We pray that you'd fill them afresh with your Holy Spirit and that the world that is about to encounter them would never be the same, because a whole lot of people are going to go out right now with truth in both barrels. May they go out and be presenting the truth in love. We ask it in Jesus' name, and all God's people said, amen. Amen.